Chapter 18. Why, anything. An honorable murderer, if you will. For naught I did in hate, but all in honor. Othello. The bloody and inhuman scene, rather incidentally mentioned than described in the preceding chapter, is conspicuous in the pages of colonial history by the merited title of The Massacre of William Henry. It so far deepened the stain which a previous and very similar event had left upon the reputation of the French commander that it was not entirely erased by his early and glorious death. It is now becoming obscured by time, and thousands, who know that Montcalm died like a hero on the plains of Abraham, have yet to learn how much he was deficient in that moral courage without which no man can be truly great. Pages might be written to prove from this illustrious example the defects of human excellence, to show how easy it is for generous sentiments, high courtesy, and chivalrous courage to lose their influence beneath the chilling blight of selfishness, and to exhibit to the world a man who was great in all the minor attributes of character, but who was found wanting when it became necessary to prove how much principle is superior to policy. But the task would exceed our prerogatives. And as history, like love, is so apt to surround her heroes with an atmosphere of imaginary brightness, it is probable that Louis de Saint-Véran will be viewed by posterity only as the gallant defender of his country, while his cruel apathy on the shores of the Oswego and of the Horican will be forgotten. Deeply regretting this weakness on the part of a sister muse, we shall at once retire from her sacred precincts within the proper limits of our own humble vocation. The third day from the capture of the fort was drawing to a close, but the business of the narrative must still detain the reader on the shores of the Holy Lake. When last seen, the environs of the works were filled with violence and uproar. They were now possessed by stillness and death. The blood-stained conquerors had departed, and their camp, which had so lately rung with the merry rejoicings of a victorious army, lay a silent and deserted city of huts. The fortress was a smoldering ruin, charred rafters, fragments of exploded artillery, and rent masonwork, covering its earthen mounds in confused disorder. A frightful change had also occurred in the season. The sun had hid its warmth behind an impenetrable mass of vapor, and hundreds of human forms, which had blackened beneath the fierce heats of August, were stiffening in their deformity before the blasts of a premature November. The curling and spotless mists, which had been sailing above the hills towards the north, were now returning in an interminable dusky sheet that was urged along by the fury of a tempest. The crowded mirror of the Horican was gone, and in its place the green and angry waters lashed the shores as if indignantly casting back its impurities to the polluted strand. Still the clear fountain retained a portion of its charmed influence, but it reflected only the somber gloom that fell from the impending heavens. That humid and congenial atmosphere which commonly adorned the view, veiling its harshness and softening its asperities, had disappeared, and the northern air poured across the waste of water so harsh and unmingled that nothing was left to be conjectured by the eye or fashioned by the fancy. The fiercer element had cropped the verdure of the plain, which looked as though it were scathed by the consuming lightning, but here and there a dark green tuft rose in the midst of the desolation, the earliest fruits of a soil that had been fattened with human blood. The whole landscape, which, seen by a favoring light and in a genial temperature, had been found so lovely, appeared now like some pictured allegory of life in which objects were arrayed in their harshest but truest colors and without the relief of any shadowing. The solitary and arid blades of grass arose from the passing gusts, fearfully perceptible. The bold and rocky mountains were too distinct in their barrenness, and the eye even sought relief in vain by attempting to pierce the illimitable void of heaven, which was shut to its gaze by the dusky sheet of ragged and driving vapor. The wind blew unequally, sometimes sweeping heavily along the ground, seeming to whisper its moanings in the cold ears of the dead, then rising in a shrill and mournful whistling, It entered the forest with a rush that filled the air with the leaves and branches it scattered in its path. Amid the unnatural shower, a few hungry ravens struggled with the gale. But no sooner was the green ocean of woods, which stretched beneath them, past, than they gladly stopped at random to their hideous banquet. In short, it was the scene of wildness and desolation, and it appeared as if all who had profanely entered it had been stricken at a blow by the relentless arm of death. But the prohibition had ceased, and for the first time since the perpetrators of those foul deeds which had assisted to disfigure the scene were gone, living human beings had now presumed to approach the place. About an hour before the setting of the sun, on the day already mentioned, the forms of 5 men might have been seen issuing from the narrow vista of trees where the path to the Hudson entered the forest, and advancing in the direction of the ruined works. At first their progress was slow and guarded, as though they entered with reluctance amid the horrors of the spot, or dreaded the renewal of its frightful incidents. A light figure preceded the rest of the party with the caution and activity of a native, ascending every hillock to reconnoiter, and indicating by gestures to his companions the route he deemed it most prudent to pursue. Nor were those in the rear wanting in every caution and foresight known to forest warfare. One among them, he also was an Indian, moved a little on one flank and watched the margin of the woods with eyes long accustomed to read the smallest sign of danger. The remaining 3 were white, though clad in vestments adapted, both in quality and color, to their present hazardous pursuit, that of hanging on the skirts of a retiring army in the wilderness. The effects produced by the appalling sights that constantly arose in their path to the lake shore were as different as the characters of the respective individuals who composed the party. The youth in front threw serious but furtive glances at the mangled victims as he stepped lightly across the plain, afraid to exhibit his feelings, and yet too inexperienced to quell entirely their sudden and powerful influence. His red associate, however, was superior to such a weakness. He passed the groups of dead with a steadiness of purpose and an eye so calm that nothing but long and inveterate practice could enable him to maintain. The sensations produced in the minds of even the white men were different, though uniformly sorrowful. One, whose gray locks and furrowed lineaments, blending with a martial air and tread, betrayed, in spite of the disguise of a woodsman's dress, a man long experienced in scenes of war, was not ashamed to groan aloud whenever a spectacle of more than usual horror came under his view. The young man at his elbow shuddered, but seemed to suppress his feelings in tenderness to his companion. Of them all, the straggler who brought up the rear appeared alone to betray his real thoughts, without fear of observation or dread of consequences. He gazed at the most appalling sight with eyes and muscles that knew not how to waver, but with execrations so bitter and deep as to denote how much he denounced the crime of his enemies. The reader will perceive at once, in these respective characters, the Mohicans and their white friend the scout, together with Monroe and Hayward. It was, in truth, the father in quest of his children, attended by the youth who felt so deep a stake in their happiness, and those brave and trusty foresters who had already proved their skill and fidelity through the trying scenes related. When Uncas, who moved in front, had reached the center of the plain, he raised a cry that drew his companions in a body to the spot. The young warrior had halted over a group of females who lay in a cluster, a confused mass of dead. Notwithstanding the revolting horror of the exhibition, Monroe and Hayward flew towards the festering heap, endeavoring, with a love that no unseemliness could extinguish, to discover whether any vestiges of those they sought were to be seen among the tattered and many-colored garments. The father and lover found instant relief in the search, though each was condemned again to experience the misery at an uncertainty that was hardly less insupportable than the most revolting truth. They were standing, silent and thoughtful, around the melancholy pile when the scout approached. Eyeing the sad spectacle with an angry countenance, the sturdy woodsman, for the first time since his entering the plain, spoke intelligibly and aloud. "I have been on many a shocking field, and have followed a trail of blood for many miles," he said. but never have I found the hand of the devil so plain as it is here to be seen. Revenge is an Indian feeling, and all who know me know that there is no cross in my veins. But this much will I say. Here, in the face of heaven, and with the power of the Lord so manifest in this howling wilderness, that should these Frenchers ever trust themselves again within the range of a ragged bullet, there is one rifle shall play its part so long as flint will fire or powder burn. I leave the tomahawk and knife to such as have a natural gift to use them. What say you, Chingachgook? He added in Delaware. Shall the Hurons boast of this to their women when the deep snows come? A gleam of resentment flashed across the dark lineaments of the Mohican chief. He loosened his knife in its sheath, and then, turning calmly from the sight, his countenance settled into a repose as deep as if he never knew the instigation of passion. "Montcalm, Montcalm," continued the deeply resentful and less self-restrained scout. "They say a time must come when all the deeds done in the flesh will be seen at a single look, and that by eyes cleared from mortal infirmities. Woe betide the wretch who is born to behold this plain with the judgment hanging about his soul. Huh! As I am a man of white blood, yonder lies a redskin, without the hair of his head where nature rooted it. Look at him, Delaware. It may be one of your missing people, and he should have burial like a stout warrior. I see it in your eye, Sagamore. A Huron pays for this. Afore the fall winds have blown away the scent of the blood." Chingachgook approached the mutilated form, and turning it over, he found the distinguishing marks of one of those six allied tribes, or nations as they were called, who, while they fought in the English ranks, were so deadly hostile to his own people. Spurning the loathsome object with his foot, he turned from it with the same indifference he would have quitted a brute carcass. The scout comprehended the action and very deliberately pursued his own way, continuing, however, his denunciations against the French commander in the same resentful strain. Nothing but vast wisdom and unlimited power should dare to sweep off men in multitudes, he added, for it is only the one that can know the necessity of the judgment. And what is there short of the other that can replace the creatures of the Lord? I hold it a sin to kill the second buck afore the first is eaten, unless a march in the front or an ambushment be contemplated. It is a different matter with a few warriors in open and rugged fight, for 'tis their gift to die with the rifle or the tomahawk in hand, according as their natures may happen to be white or red. Uncas, come this way, lad, and let the ravens settle upon the Mingo. I know, from often seeing it, that they have a craving for the flesh of an Oneida, and it is well to let the bird follow the gift of its natural appetite. Huh! Exclaimed the young Mohican, rising on the extremities of his feet, and gazing intently in his front, frightening the raven to some other prey by the sound and the action. What is it, boy? Whispered the scout, lowering his tall form into a crouching attitude like a panther about to take his leap. God send it be a tardy Frencher, skulking for plunder. I do believe Killdeer would take an uncommon range today. Uncas, without making any reply, bounded away from the spot, and in the next instant he was seen tearing from a bush and waving in triumph a fragment of the green riding veil of Cora. The movement, the exhibition, and the cry, which again burst from the lips of the young Mohican, instantly drew the whole party about him. "My child," said Monroe, speaking quick and wildly. "Give me my child." "Uncas will try," was the short and touching answer. The simple but meaning assurance was lost on the father, who seized the piece of gauze and crushed it in his hand, while his eyes roamed fearfully among the bushes, as if he equally dreaded and hoped for the secrets they might reveal. "Here are no dead," said Hayward. "The storm seems not to have passed this way." "That's manifest, and clearer than the heavens above our heads," returned the undisturbed scout. "But either she or they that have robbed her have passed the bush, for I remember the rag she wore to hide a face that all did love to look upon. Uncas, you are right. The dark hair has been here, and she has fled like a frightened fawn to the wood. None who could fly would remain to be murdered. Let us search for the marks she left, for to Indian eyes I sometimes think even a hummingbird leaves his trail in the air. The young Mohican darted away at the suggestion, and the scout had hardly done speaking before the former raised the cry of success from the margin of the forest. On reaching the spot, the anxious party perceived another portion of the veil fluttering on the lower branch of a beech. "Softly, softly," said the scout, extending his long rifle in front of the eager Hayward. "We now know our work, but the beauty of the trail must not be deformed. A step too soon may give us hours of trouble. We have them, though. That much is beyond denial."
Bless ye, worthy man," exclaimed Monroe. "Whither, then, have they fled? And where are my babes?"
"The path they have taken depends on many chances. If they have gone alone, they are quite as likely to move in a circle as straight, and they may be within a dozen miles of us. But if the Hurons or any of the French Indians have laid hands on them, 'tis probable they are now near the borders of the Canadas. But what matters that," continued the deliberate scout, observing the powerful anxiety and disappointment the listeners exhibited, "here are the Mohicans and I on one end of the trail, and rely on it, we find the other, though they should be 100 leagues asunder. Gently, gently, Uncas, you are as impatient as a man in the settlements. You forget that light feet leave but faint marks."
"Huh!" exclaimed Chingachgook,
who had been occupied in examining an opening that had been evidently made through the low underbrush which skirted the forest, and who now stood erect as he pointed downwards in the attitude and with the air of a man who beheld a disgusting serpent.
"Here is the palpable impression of the footstep of a man," cried Hayward, bending over the indicated spot. "He has trod in the margin of this pool, and the mark cannot be mistaken. They are captives."
"Better so than left to starve in the wilderness," returned the scout, "and they will leave a wider trail. I would wager 50 beaver skins against as many flints that the Mohicans and I enter their wigwams within the month. Stoop to it, Uncas, and try what you can make of the moccasin, for moccasin it plainly is, and no shoe." The young Mohican bent over the track, and removing the scattered leaves from around the place, he examined it with much of that sort of scrutiny that a money dealer, in these days of pecuniary doubts, would bestow on a suspected due bill. At length he arose from his knees, satisfied with the result of the examination. "Well, boy," demanded the attentive scout, "what does it say? Can you make anything of the telltale?"
"Le renard sutil."
"Ha! That rampaging devil again. There never will be an end of his loping till Killdeer has said a friendly word to him." Hayward reluctantly admitted the truth of this intelligence, and now expressed rather his hopes than his doubts by saying,
"One moccasin is so much like another. It is probable there is some mistake."
"One moccasin like another? You may as well say that one foot is like another, though we all know that some are long and others short, some broad and others narrow, some with high and some with low insteps, some in-toed and some out. One moccasin is no more like another than one book is like another, though they who can read in one are seldom able to tell the marks of the other, which is all ordered for the best, giving to every man his natural advantages. Let me get down to it, Uncas. Neither book nor moccasin is the worse for having two opinions instead of one." The scout stooped to the task, and instantly added, "You are right, boy. Here is the patch we saw so often in the other chase, and the fellow will drink when he can get an opportunity. Your drinking Indian always learns to walk with a wider toe than the natural savage, it being the gift of a drunkard to straddle, whether of white or red skin. 'Tis just the length and breadth, too. Look at it, Sagamore. You measured the prints more than once when we hunted the varmints from glens to the health springs." Chingachgook complied, and after finishing his short examination, he arose, and with a quiet demeanor he merely pronounced the word, "Magua." "Aye, 'tis a settled thing. Here, then, have passed the Dark Hair and Magua."
"And not Alice?" demanded Hayward.
"Of her we have not yet seen the signs," returned the scout, looking closely around at the trees, the bushes, and the ground. "What have we there? Uncas, bring hither the thing you see dangling from yonder thorn bush." When the Indian had complied, the scout received the prize, and holding it on high, he laughed in his silent but heartfelt manner. "'Tis the tooting weapon of the singer. Now we shall have a trail a priest might travel," he said.
Uncas, look for the marks of a shoe that is long enough to uphold 6 feet 2 of tottering human flesh. I begin to have some hopes of the fellow, since he has given up squalling to follow some better trade.
At least he has been faithful to his trust, said Hayward, and Cora and Alice are not without a friend.
Yes, said Hawkeye, dropping his rifle, and leaning on it with an air of visible contempt. He will do their singing. Can he slay a buck for their dinner, journey by the moss on the beaches, or cut the throat of a Huron? If not, the first catbird he meets is the cleverest of the two. Well, boy, any signs of such a foundation?
Here is something like the footstep of one who has worn a shoe. Can it be that of our friend?
Touch the leaves lightly, or you'll disconcert the formation. That is the print of a foot, but 'tis the dark hairs, and small it is, too, for one of such a noble height and grand appearance. The singer would cover it with his heel.
Where? Let me look on the footsteps of my child, said Monroe, shoving the bushes aside and bending fondly over the nearly obliterated impression.
Though the tread which had left the mark had been light and rapid, it was still plainly visible. The aged soldier examined it with eyes that grew dim as he gazed. Nor did he rise from his stooping posture until Hayward saw that he had watered the trace of his daughter's passage with a scalding tear. Willing to divert a distress which threatened each moment to break through the restraint of appearances by giving the veteran something to do, the young man said to the scout,
"As we now possess these infallible signs, let us commence our march. A moment at such a time will appear an age to the captives."
"It is not the swiftest leaping deer that gives the longest chase," returned Hawkeye, without moving his eyes from the different marks that had come under his view. "We know that the rampaging Huron has passed, and the dark hair, and the singer. But where is she of the yellow locks and blue eyes? Though little, and far from being as bold as her sister, she is fair to the view and pleasant in discourse. Has she no friend, that none care for her?"
"God forbid she should ever want hundreds. Are we not now in her pursuit? For one, I will never cease the search till she be found."
"In that case we may have to journey by different paths, for here she has not passed, light and little as her footstep would be." Hayward drew back, all his ardor to proceed seeming to vanish on the instant. Without attending to this sudden change in the other's humor, the scout, after musing a moment, continued, "There is no woman in this wilderness could leave such a print as that but the dark hair or her sister. We know that the first has been here. But where are the signs of the other? Let us push deeper on the trail, and if nothing offers, we must go back to the plain and strike another scent. Move on, Uncas, and keep your eyes on the dried leaves. I will watch the bushes, while your father shall run with a low nose to the ground. Move on, friends. The sun is getting behind the hills."
"Is there nothing that I can do?" demanded the anxious Hayward.
"You," repeated the scout, who, with his red friends, was already advancing in the order he had prescribed. "Yes, you can keep in our rear, and be careful not to cross the trail."
Before they had proceeded many rods, the Indians stopped and appeared to gaze at some signs on the earth with more than their usual keenness. Both father and son spoke quick and loud, now looking at the object of their mutual admiration, and now regarding each other with the most unequivocal pleasure.
"They have found the little foot," exclaimed the scout, moving forward, without attending further to his own portion of the duty. "What have we here? An ambushment has been planted in the spot? No. By the truest rifle on the frontiers, here have been them one-sided horses again. Now the whole secret is out, and all is plain as the North Star at midnight. Yes, here they have mounted. There the beasts have been bound to a sapling, in waiting. And yonder runs the broad path away to the north, in full sweep for the Canadas."
"But still there are no signs of Alice, of the younger Miss Monroe," said Duncan.
"Unless the shining bauble Uncas has just lifted from the ground should prove one. Pass it this way, lad, that we may look at it."
Hayward instantly knew it for a trinket that Alice was fond of wearing, and which he recollected with the tenacious memory of a lover to have seen on the fatal morning of the massacre dangling from the fair neck of his mistress.
He seized the highly prized jewel,
And as he proclaimed the fact, it vanished from the eyes of the wondering scout, who in vain looked for it on the ground long after it was warmly pressed against the beating heart of Duncan.
"Pshaw," said the disappointed Hawkeye, ceasing to rake the leaves with the breech of his rifle. "'Tis a certain sign of age when the sight begins to weaken. Such a glittering gewgaw, and not to be seen. Oh, well, I can squint along a clouded barrel yet, and that is enough to settle all disputes between me and the Mingos. I should like to find the thing, too, if it were only to carry it to the right owner, and that would be bringing the two ends of what I call a long trail together. For by this time the broad St. Lawrence, or perhaps the Great Lakes themselves, are atwixt us."
"So much the more reason why we should not delay our march," returned Hayward. "Let us proceed."
"Young blood and hot blood, they say, are much the same thing. We are not about to start on a squirrel hunt, or to drive a deer into the Horican, but to outlie for days and nights, and to stretch across a wilderness where the feet of men seldom go, and where no bookish knowledge would carry you through harmless. An Indian never starts on such an expedition without smoking over his council fire, and though a man of white blood, I honor their customs in this particular, seeing that they are deliberate and wise. We will therefore go back and light our fire tonight in the ruins of the old fort, and in the morning we shall be fresh and ready to undertake our work like men, and not like babbling women or eager boys."
Hayward saw by the manner of the scout that altercation would be useless. Monroe had again sunk into that sort of apathy which had beset him since his late overwhelming misfortunes, and from which he was apparently to be roused only by some new and powerful excitement. Making a merit of necessity, the young man took the veteran by the arm and followed in the footsteps of the Indians and the scout, who had already begun to retrace the path which conducted them to the plain.
Chapter 19. Solario. "Why, I am sure if he forfeit, thou wilt not take his flesh. What's that good for?"
Shylock. "To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge." Merchant of Venice.
The shades of evening had come to increase the dreariness of the place when the party entered the ruins of William Henry. The scout and his companions immediately made their preparations to pass the night there, but with an earnestness and sobriety of demeanor that betrayed how much the unusual horrors they had just witnessed worked on even their practiced feelings. A few fragments of rafters were reared against a blackened wall, and when Uncas had covered them slightly with brush, the temporary accommodations were deemed sufficient. The young Indian pointed towards his rude hut when his labor was ended, and Hayward, who understood the meaning of the silent gesture, gently urged Monroe to enter. Leaving the bereaved old man alone with his sorrows, Duncan immediately returned to the open air, too much excited himself to seek the repose he had recommended to his veteran friend. While Hawkeye and the Indians lighted their fire and took their evening's repast, a frugal meal of dried bear's meat, the young man paid a visit to that curtain of the dilapidated fort which looked out on the sheet of the Horican. The wind had fallen, and the waves were already rolling on the sandy beach beneath him in a more regular and tempered succession. The clouds, as if tired of their furious chase, were breaking asunder, the heavier volumes gathering in black masses about the horizon, while the lighter scud still hurried above the water or eddied among the tops of the mountains, like broken flights of birds hovering around their roosts. Here and there a red and fiery star struggled through the drifting vapor, furnishing a lurid gleam of brightness to the dull aspect of the heavens. Within the bosom of the encircling hills, an impenetrable darkness had already settled, and the plain lay like a vast and deserted charnel house, without omen or whisper to disturb the slumbers of its numerous and hapless tenants. Of this scene, so chillingly in accordance with the past, Duncan stood for many minutes a rapt observer. His eyes wandered from the bosom of the mound, where the foresters were seated around their glimmering fire, to the fainter light which still lingered in the skies, and then rested long and anxiously on the embodied gloom, which lay like a dreary void on that side of him where the dead reposed. He soon fancied that inexplicable sounds arose from the place, though so indistinct and stolen as to render not only their nature but even their existence uncertain. Ashamed of his apprehensions, the young man turned towards the water, and strove to divert his attentions to the mimic stars that dimly glimmered on its moving surface. Still, his too conscious ears performed their ungrateful duty, as if to warn him of some lurking danger. At length, a swift trampling seemed quite audibly to rush athwart the darkness. Unable any longer to quiet his uneasiness, Duncan spoke in a low voice to the scout, requesting him to ascend the mound to the place where he stood. Hawkeye threw his rifle across an arm and complied, but with an air so unmoved and calm as to prove how much he counted on the security of their position.
"Listen," said Duncan, when the other placed himself deliberately at his elbow. "There are suppressed noises on the plain which may show that Montcalm has not yet entirely deserted his conquest."
"Then ears are better than eyes," said the undisturbed scout, who, having just deposited a portion of bear between his grinders, spoke thick and slow, like one whose mouth was doubly occupied. "I myself saw him caged in Thai with all his host. For your Frenchers, when they have done a clever thing, like to get back and have a dance or a merrymaking with the women over their success."
"I know not. An Indian seldom sleeps in war, and plunder may keep a Huron here after his tribe has departed. It would be well to extinguish the fire and have a watch. Listen, you hear the noise I mean."
"An Indian more rarely lurks about the graves. Though ready to slay and not over-regardful of the means, he is commonly content with the scalp, unless when blood is hot and temper up. But after the spirit is once fairly gone, he forgets his enmity and is willing to let the dead find their natural rest. Speaking of spirits, Major, are you of the opinion that the heaven of a redskin and of us whites will be one and the same?"
"No doubt. No doubt. I thought I heard it again. Or was it the rustling of the leaves in the top of the beach?"
"For my own part," continued Hawkeye, turning his face for a moment in the direction indicated by Hayward, but with a vacant and careless manner, "I believe that paradise is ordained for happiness, and that men will be indulged in it according to their dispositions and gifts. I therefore judge that a redskin is not far from the truth when he believes he is to find them glorious hunting grounds of which his traditions tell. Nor, for that matter, do I think it would be any disparagement to a man without a cross to pass his time—"
"You hear it again," interrupted Duncan.
Aye, when food is scarce, and when food is plenty, a wolf grows bold," said the unmoved scout. "There would be picking, too, among the skins of the devils, if there was light and time for the sport. But concerning the life that is to come, Major, I have heard preachers say in the settlements that heaven was a place of rest. Now men's minds differ as to their ideas of enjoyment. For myself, I say it with reverence to the ordering of Providence, it would be no great indulgence to be kept shut up in those mansions of which they preach, having a natural longing for motion and the chase." Duncan, who was now made to understand the nature of the noises he had heard, answered with more attention to the subject which the humor of the scout had chosen for discussion by saying,
"It is difficult to account for the feelings that may attend the last great change."
"It would be change indeed, for a man who has passed his days in the open air," returned the single-minded scout, "and who has so often broken his fast on the headwaters of the Hudson to sleep within sound of the roaring Mohawk. But it is a comfort to know we serve a merciful master, though we do it each after his fashion, and with great tracts of wilderness atween us. What goes there?"
"Is it not the rushing of the wolves you have mentioned?"
Hawkeye slowly shook his head, and beckoned for Duncan to follow him to a spot to which the glare from the fire did not extend. When he had taken this precaution, the scout placed himself in an attitude of intense attention, and listened long and keenly for a repetition of the low sound that had so unexpectedly startled him. His vigilance, however, seemed exercised in vain, for after a fruitless pause, he whispered to Duncan, "We must give a call to Uncas. The boy has Indian senses, and may hear what is hid from us, for being a white skin I will not deny my nature." The young Mohican, who was conversing in a low voice with his father, started as he heard the moaning of an owl, and springing on his feet he looked towards the black mounds as if seeking the place whence the sounds proceeded.
The scout repeated the call, and in a few moments Duncan saw the figure of Uncas stealing cautiously along the rampart to the spot where they stood. Hawkeye explained his wishes in a very few words which were spoken in the Delaware tongue. So soon as Uncas was in possession of the reason why he was summoned, he threw himself flat on the turf, where, to the eyes of Duncan, he appeared to lie quiet and motionless. Surprised at the immovable attitude of the young warrior, and curious to observe the manner in which he employed his faculties to obtain the desired information, Hayward advanced a few steps, and bent over the dark object on which he had kept his eyes riveted. Then it was he discovered that the form of Uncas had vanished, and that he beheld only the dark outline of an inequality in the embankment. "What has become of the Mohican?" he demanded of the scout, stepping back in amazement. "It was here that I saw him fall, and I could have sworn that here he yet remained." "Hist! Speak lower. For we know not what ears are open, and the Mingos are a quick-witted breed. As for Uncas, he is out on the plain, and the Maquas, if any such are about us, will find their equal." "You think that Montcalm has not called off all his Indians? Let us give the alarm to our companions, that we may stand to our arms. Here are five of us who are not unused to meet an enemy. Not a word to either, as you value life. Look at the Sagamore, how like a grand Indian chief he sits by the fire. If there are any skulkers out in the darkness, they will never discover by his countenance that we suspect danger at hand."
"But they may discover him, and it will prove his death. His person can be too plainly seen by the light of that fire, and he will become the first and most certain victim."
"It is undeniable that now you speak the truth," returned the scout, betraying more anxiety than was usual. "Yet what can be done? A single suspicious look might bring on an attack before we are ready to receive it. He knows, by the call I gave to Uncas, that we have struck a scent. I will tell him that we are on the trail of the Mingos. His Indian nature will teach him how to act." The scout applied his fingers to his mouth and raised a low hissing sound that caused Duncan at first to start aside, believing that he heard a serpent. The head of Chingachgook was resting on a hand as he sat musing by himself. But the moment he heard the warning of the animal whose name he bore, it arose to an upright position, and his dark eyes glanced swiftly and keenly on every side of him. With this sudden and perhaps involuntary movement, every appearance of surprise or alarm ended. His rifle lay untouched and apparently unnoticed within reach of his hand. The tomahawk that he had loosened in his belt for the sake of ease was even suffered to fall from its usual situation to the ground, and his form seemed to sink like that of a man whose nerves and sinews were suffered to relax for the purpose of rest. Cunningly resuming his former position, though with a change of hands, as if the movement had been made merely to relieve the limb, the native awaited the result with a calmness and fortitude that none but an Indian warrior would have known how to exercise. But Hayward saw that while to a less instructed eye the Mohican chief appeared to slumber, his nostrils were expanded, his head was turned a little to one side as if to assist the organs of hearing, and that his quick and rapid glances ran incessantly over every object within the power of his vision.
"See the noble fellow?" whispered Hawkeye, pressing the arm of Hayward. "He knows that a look or a motion might disconcert our schemes and put us at the mercy of them imps." He was interrupted by the flash and report of a rifle. The air was filled with sparks of fire around the spot where the eyes of Hayward were still fastened with admiration and wonder. A second look told him that Chingachgook had disappeared in the confusion. In the meantime, the scout had thrown forward his rifle, like one prepared for service, and awaited impatiently the moment when an enemy might rise to view. But with the solitary and fruitless attempt made on the life of Chingachgook, the attack appeared to have terminated. Once or twice the listeners thought they could distinguish the distant rustling of bushes, as bodies of some unknown description rushed through them. Nor was it long before Hawkeye pointed out the scampering of wolves, as they fled precipitately before the passage of some intruder on their proper domains. After an impatient and breathless pause, a plunge was heard in the water, and it was immediately followed by the report of another rifle. "There goes Uncas," said the scout. "The boy bears a smart piece. I know its crack as well as a father knows the language of his child, for I carried the gun myself until a better offered."
"What can this mean?" demanded Duncan. "We are watched, and, as it would seem, marked for destruction."
"Yonder scattered brand can witness that no good was intended, and this Indian will testify that no harm has been done," returned the scout, dropping his rifle across his arm again and following Chingachgook, who just then reappeared within the circle of light into the bosom of the works. "How is it, Sagamore? Are the Mingos upon us in earnest? Or is it only one of those reptiles who hang upon the skirts of a war party to scalp the dead, go in and make their boast among the squaws of the valiant deeds done on the palefaces?" Chingachgook very quietly resumed his seat. Nor did he make any reply until after he had examined the firebrand which had been struck by the bullet that had nearly proved fatal to himself. After which he was content to reply, holding a single finger up to view with the English monosyllable, "One." "I thought as much," returned Hawkeye, seating himself. "And as he had got the cover of the lake afore Uncas pulled upon him, it is more than probable the knave will sing his lies about some great ambushment, in which he was outlying on the trail of two Mohicans and a white hunter, for the officers can be considered as little better than idlers in such a scrimmage. Well, let him. Let him. There are always some honest men in every nation, though heavens know, too, that they are scarce among the Maquas, to look down an upstart when he brags agin the face of reason. The varlet sent his lead within whistle of your ears, Sagamore." Chingachgook turned a calm and incurious eye towards the place where the ball had struck, and then resumed his former attitude, with a composure that could not be disturbed by so trifling an incident. Just then Uncas glided into the circle, and seated himself at the fire, with the same appearance of indifference as was maintained by his father. Of these several movements, Hayward was a deeply interested and wondering observer. It appeared to him as though the foresters had some secret means of intelligence which had escaped the vigilance of his own faculties. In place of that eager and garrulous narration with which a white youth would have endeavored to communicate and perhaps exaggerate that which had passed out in the darkness of the plain, the young warrior was seemingly content to let his deeds speak for themselves. It was, in fact, neither the moment nor the occasion for an Indian to boast of his exploits. And it is probable that had Hayward neglected to inquire, not another syllable would just then have been uttered on the subject. "What has become of our enemy, Uncas?" demanded Duncan. "We heard your rifle, and hoped you had not fired in vain." The young chief removed a fold of his hunting shirt and quietly exposed the fatal tuft of hair, which he bore as the symbol of victory. Chingachgook laid his hand on the scalp and considered it for a moment with deep attention. Then dropping it, with disgust depicted in his strong features, he ejaculated, "Oneida!" "Oneida!" repeated the scout, who was fast losing his interest in the scene, in an apathy nearly assimilated to that of his red associates, but who now advanced with uncommon earnestness to regard the bloody badge. "By the Lord, if the Oneidas are outlying upon the trail, we shall be flanked by devils on every side of us. Now, to white eyes there is no difference between this bit of skin and that of any other Indian, and yet the Sagamore declares it came from the poll of a Mingo. Nay, he even names the tribe of the poor devil with as much ease as if the scalp was the leaf of a book and each hair a letter. What right have Christian whites to boast of their learning when a savage can read a language that would prove too much for the wisest of them all? What say you, lad? Of what people was the knave?" Uncas raised his eyes to the face of the scout and answered in his soft voice, "Oneida." "Oneida again. When one Indian makes a declaration, it is commonly true, but when he is supported by his people, set it down as gospel."
"The poor fellow has mistaken us for French," said Hayward, "or he would not have attempted the life of a friend."
"He mistake a Mohican in his paint for a Huron? You would be as likely to mistake the white-coated grenadiers of Montcalm for the scarlet jackets of the Royal Americans," returned the scout. "Oh, no, the Sarpent knew his errand. Nor was there any great mistake in the matter, for there is but little love atween a Delaware and a Mingo, let their tribes go out to fight for whom they may in a white quarrel. For that matter, though the Oneidas do serve his sacred majesty, who is my own sovereign lord and master, I should not have deliberated long about letting off killdeer at the imp myself, had luck thrown him in my way."
"That would have been an abuse of our treaties, and unworthy of your character.
When a man consorts much with a people, continued Hawkeye, if they are honest and he no knave, love will grow up atwixt them. It is true that white cunning has managed to throw the tribes into great confusion as respects friends and enemies, so that the Hurons and the Oneidas, who speak the same tongue, or what may be called the same, take each other's scalps, and the Delawares are divided among themselves, a few hanging about their great council fire on their own river and fighting on the same side with the Mingos, while the greater part are in the Canadas, out of natural enmity to the Maquas, thus throwing everything into disorder and destroying all the harmony of warfare. Yet a red nature is not likely to alter with every shift of policy. So that the love atwixt a Mohican and a Mingo is much like the regard between a white man and a serpent.
I regret to hear it, for I had believed those natives who dwelt within our boundaries had found us too just and liberal not to identify themselves fully with our quarrels.
Why, I believe it is nature to give a preference to one's own quarrels before those of strangers. Now, for myself, I do love justice, and therefore I will not say I hate a Mingo, for that may be unsuitable to my color and my religion, though I will just repeat, it may have been owing to the night that Killdeer had no hand in the death of this skulking Oneida.
Then, as if satisfied with the force of his own reasons, whatever might be their effect on the opinions of the other disputant, the honest but implacable woodsman turned from the fire, content to let the controversy slumber. Hayward withdrew to the rampart, too uneasy and too little accustomed to the warfare of the woods to remain at ease under the possibility of such insidious attacks. Not so, however, with the scout and the Mohicans. Those acute and long-practiced senses, whose powers so often exceed the limits of all ordinary credulity, after having detected the danger, had enabled them to ascertain its magnitude and duration. Not one of the three appeared in the least to doubt their perfect security, as was indicated by the preparations that were soon made to sit in council over their future proceedings. The confusion of nations, and even of tribes to which Hawkeye alluded, existed at that period in the fullest force. The great tie of language, and of course of a common origin, was severed in many places, and it was one of its consequences that the Delaware and the Mingo, as the people of the Six Nations were called, were found fighting in the same ranks, while the latter sought the scalp of the Huron, though believed to be the root of his own stock. The Delawares were even divided among themselves. Though love of the soil which had belonged to his ancestors kept the Sagamore of the Mohicans with a small band of followers who were serving at Edward under the banners of the English king, by far the largest portion of his nation were known to be in the field as allies of Montcalm. The reader probably knows, if enough has not already been gleaned from this narrative, that the Delaware, or Lenape, claimed to be the progenitors of that numerous people who once were masters of most of the eastern and northern states of America, of whom the community of the Mohicans was an ancient and highly honored member. It was, of course, with a perfect understanding of the minute and intricate interest which had armed friend against friend and brought natural enemies to combat by each other's side, that the scout and his companions now disposed of themselves to deliberate on the measures that were to govern their future movements amid so many jarring and savage races of men. Duncan knew enough of Indian customs to understand the reason that the fire was replenished, and why the warriors, not accepting Hawkeye, took their seats within the curl of its smoke with so much gravity and decorum. Placing himself at an angle of the works where he might be a spectator of the scene within, while he kept a watchful eye against any danger from without, he awaited the result with as much patience as he could summon. After a short and impressive pause, Chingachgook lighted a pipe whose bowl was curiously carved in one of the soft stones of the country, and whose stem was a tube of wood, and commenced smoking. When he had inhaled enough of the fragrance of the soothing weed, he passed the instrument into the hands of the scout. In this manner the pipe had made its rounds three several times, amid the most profound silence, before either of the party opened his lips. Then the Sagamore, as the oldest and highest in rank, in a few calm and dignified words, proposed the subject for deliberation. He was answered by the scout, and Chingachgook rejoined when the other objected to his opinions. But the youthful Uncas continued a silent and respectful listener, until Hawkeye, in complacence, demanded his opinion. Hayward gathered from the manners of the different speakers that the father and son espoused one side of a disputed question, while the white man maintained the other. The contest gradually grew warmer, until it was quite evident the feelings of the speakers began to be somewhat enlisted in the debate. Notwithstanding the increasing warmth of the amicable contest, the most decorous Christian assembly, not even accepting those in which its reverend ministers are collected, might have learned a wholesome lesson of moderation from the forbearance and courtesy of the disputants. The words of Uncas were received with the same deep attention as those which fell from the maturer wisdom of his father, and so far from manifesting any impatience, neither spoke in reply until a few moments of silent meditation were seemingly bestowed in deliberating on what had already been said. The language of the Mohicans was accompanied by gestures so direct and natural that Hayward had but little difficulty in following the thread of their argument. On the other hand, the scout was obscure, because, from the lingering pride of color, he rather affected the cold and artificial manner which characterizes all classes of Anglo-Americans when unexcited. By the frequency with which the Indians described the marks of a forest trail, it was evident they urged a pursuit by land, while the repeated sweep of Hawkeye's arm towards the Horican denoted that he was for a passage across its waters. The latter was, to every appearance, fast losing ground, and the point was about to be decided against him, when he arose to his feet, and, shaking off his apathy, he suddenly assumed the manner of an Indian, and adopted all the arts of native eloquence. Elevating an arm, he pointed out the track of the sun, repeating the gesture for every day that was necessary to accomplish their object. Then he delineated a long and painful path amid rocks and watercourses. The age and weakness of the slumbering and unconscious Monroe were indicated by signs too palpable to be mistaken. Duncan perceived that even his own powers were spoken lightly of, as the scout extended his palm and mentioned him by appellation of the Open Hand, a name his liberality had purchased of all the friendly tribes. Then came a representation of the light and graceful movements of a canoe, set in forcible contrast to the tottering steps of one enfeebled and tired. He concluded by pointing to the scalp of the Oneida, and apparently urging the necessity of their departing speedily and in a manner that should leave no trail. The Mohicans listened gravely, and with countenances that reflected the sentiments of the speaker. Conviction gradually wrought its influence, and towards the close of Hawkeye's speech, his sentences were accompanied by the customary exclamation of commendation. In short, Uncas and his father became converts to his way of thinking, abandoning their own previously expressed opinions with a liberality and candor that, had they been the representatives of some great and civilized people, would have infallibly worked their political ruin by destroying forever their reputation for consistency. The instant the matter in discussion was decided, the debate, and everything connected with it except the results, appeared to be forgotten. Hawkeye, without looking round to read his triumph in applauding eyes, very composedly stretched his tall frame before the dying embers, and closed his own organs in sleep. Left now in a measure to themselves, the Mohicans, whose time had been so much devoted to the interests of others, seized the moment to devote some attention to themselves. Casting off at once the grave and austere demeanor of an Indian chief, Chingachgook commenced speaking to his son in the soft and playful tones of affection. Uncas gladly met the familiar air of his father, and before the hard breathing of the scout announced that he slept, a complete change was effected in the manner of his two associates. It is impossible to describe the music of their language, while thus engaged in laughter and endearments, in such a way as to render it intelligible to those whose ears have never listened to its melody. The compass of their voices, particularly that of the youth, was wonderful, extending from the deepest bass to tones that were even feminine in softness. The eyes of the father followed the plastic and ingenious movements of the son with open delight, and he never failed to smile in reply to the other's contagious but low laughter. While under the influence of these gentle and natural feelings, no trace of ferocity was to be seen in the softened features of the sagamore. His figured panoply of death looked more like a disguise assumed in mockery than a fierce enunciation of a desire to carry destruction in his footsteps. After an hour passed in the indulgence of their better feelings, Chingachgook abruptly announced his desire to sleep by wrapping his head in his blanket and stretching his form on the naked earth. The merriment of Uncas instantly ceased, and carefully raking the coals in such a manner that they should impart their warmth to his father's feet, the youth sought his own pillow among the ruins of the place. Imbibing renewed confidence from the security of these experienced foresters, Heyward soon imitated their example, and long before the night had turned, they who lay in the bosom of the ruined work seemed to slumber as heavily as the unconscious multitude whose bones were already beginning to bleach on the surrounding plain.